day and welcome to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Today's show is brought to us by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single source supplier of free range, all natural, grass fed, and grass finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that is as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more info, go to HearstRanch.com. So from beef to beef gelatin, lucky enough to have Sam Bumpus and Harry Parr of Bumpus and Parr. That's jellymongers.co.uk. Yes, they are British on today's The Food Scene. Thank you for crossing the pond.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's brilliant to be here.
Is it crossing the pond when you guys come to the US or when Americans go to London?
Who knows?
God, you didn't know I was going to ask that question. Yeah, what a stumper.
On that. I'm going to jump back in, though, on your beef gelatin, because that's actually a rather rare breed of gelatin at the moment, if you're getting technical. Most of us is pork-based.
Oh, yeah. Most of the leaf gelatin is pork.
Yeah, it's pretty much all pork-based these days.
No, not for the kosher.
Well, we have real trouble doing the kosher and halal gelatin as well.
Yeah. We're out in Malaysia recently, and we did get into some kosher gelatin there, but it's just not as good, actually, the beef stuff.
Interesting. Okay, so scratch that. Sorry, Hearst Ranch. But if you have some good stuff, send it to Bumpus and Parr.
We'd love to try it out. That'd be the challenge.
So, if you haven't guessed by the accents, where did you guys grow up?
England, pretty much.
Yeah. In central London?
I grew up in London.
Oh, excellent. Is that a rarity, too? Like, Parisians actually growing up in Paris?
Don't know. Not as much as you might think.
So, grew up in London, ate traditional London fare, pub food, whatever.
Ate pretty badly.
Yeah. Then why did you want to bring back something that everyone thought so badly of? Jellies. I mean, they have an interesting historical context in England, don't they?
They have an amazing historical context because when everyone was growing up, jelly was the thing you would have at birthday parties.
Everyone knew all about
jelly, but they didn't know about the rich history and what jelly was all about. And even going back in time, Henry VIII was, for example, really into jelly. So at one of his banquets, he would have jelly for two courses. So there's some really rich stuff going on back in time.
Yeah.
Well, I think that was basically, jelly used to be the dessert of kings. and apparently the Egyptian royals used to eat it. Although we're still looking for the royal jelly hieroglyphic.
Yeah.
If someone sees it, that'd be awesome.
Just wobbling mold.
Wobbling mold. Well, it's got to be molded, of course.
Yeah.
You got that. But, you know, if you think pre-refrigeration, chilling a jelly down would be, you know, something's pretty tricky. You'd have to have an ice house. So it's something that only the very rich could afford. And also, we're back to gelatin as well. If you've ever tried to clarify your own gelatin, it's quite a process.
Yeah.
And we've spoken to the experts in England who do nothing except for historical cooking. And we say, okay, yeah, we've tried ourselves clarifying gelatin, from scratch, and still tastes pretty meaty.
And what is the process of actual clarifying?
It's literally sort of boiling stuff up, reducing it, letting it set, clarifying it, and then repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat till you're trying to get a really, really clear set thing that you would recognise as gelatin. The problem is, it always tastes of the animal it came from. So we're wondering that, England had this rich history of jellies.
Yeah.
And yet, we think they probably all tasted of the beasts.
Well, I mean, that got me thinking, so more savory than sweet.
Mm.
But, you know, in the US, most jellies, well, at least while I was growing up with Jell-O, thought of it as a sweet, entree or...
But I think with your Jell-O set salads, you really start blurring the lines there in a kind of very medieval way, because those medieval jellies would have been quite meaty. But then when sugar started coming in, sugar was pretty exotic and expensive, so they started naturally adding that to the jelly because the jelly was expensive as well. So that's kind of where it came about. But Sam and I recently made a lot of set salads, and we were pretty shocked about what you Americans recommend mixing with your jelly.
Yeah. Marshmallows, nuts.
Well, we're bouncing all over the sort of time space continuum. I think in a sentence there, we've got medieval renaissance with all the sugar coming in, and then mid 50s and 60s.
So let's flash back to your upbringing. You mentioned that during birthday parties, jellies were kind of a fixture for children. But what were your first memories of jelly at the table?
I always got very excited about trying to make striped riband jellies, because it was just one of those waiting things. You had to wait for the layers to set.
But and riband is literally means striped.
Yeah, it's the sort of Victorian word for stripes. But, of course, waiting for layers of jelly to set when you're six is not that fun. So normally it doesn't really work, and you get this kind of mess. But that was always exciting.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the most interactive thing at all times, just because there's so much waiting.
I think the brilliant thing about jelly that we've found since we started is that everyone has these jelly stories. It was a thing of kids' parties, albeit something a bit lurid, sort of debased as a food stuff, not classy at all. But everyone has this really sort of emotional attachment to it. And I was speaking to this girl, she's a model, absolutely beautiful, painfully skinny, and she's like, oh, you do jelly? And I in fact am a jelly eating competition champion. And I think the very high point of her eating career was polishing off 14 bowls in a single sitting.
Oh, Lord.
To triumph over all her schoolmates. So everyone has this, and she loved it. Everyone has this really certainly this sort of Anglo-Saxon culture, fond memories and experiences with jelly. And the great thing is, if you're able to do fine jellies, like really good ingredients and good alcohol, importantly, like we do, then it's acceptable for people to get excited about it once more.
Oh, we'll get to the drinks a little early in the day, maybe.
Okay, fine. Fair call.
So you grew up in jelly households, not actually made of jelly, but households that serve jelly. What brought you to jelly? Because this wasn't your, thought of career path. In Jellymongers, the book I'm holding by Sterling Publishing, Sterling Epicure, it mentions that Sam may have gone into politics, and Harry, you were working in architectural.
Yeah, that's right. But Sam and I one summer decided that now was the time to get serious with our lives and get a sensible job, like a stall at London's Borough Market.
I think it's going to be more of a hobby.
Something
fun on the weekend.
So London's Borough Market is this very famous food market where they sell all sorts of interesting produce, and they also sell a lot of ready-made food as well. But we decided that what they really needed and what the people needed was jelly, because no one was doing jelly. We didn't really understand why they needed a nice, light, fresh, wobbly dessert.
Yeah.
So away we went in with our application to get our stall there, and unfortunately they told us to get lost.
I thought you were going to say bug off or something more British. Yeah. So they told you, no, get away.
Said,
no
one
I think Harry was being polite.
Yeah.
They weren't polite at all, but it must have been something to do with the fact that I was calling them up every hour on the hour saying, we're so excited. We've got this jelly sauce. It's going to be genius. It's going to revolutionise your market. And they were just like, never call us again.
Yeah.
Get out of here. But it was from there that our jelly adventure started.
Yeah.
Disheartened.
We discovered that everyone was indeed like really still into jelly. So we started making all these jellies with lots of fresh fruit, and it was amazing the reaction that it had, and people absolutely loved it. So we knew we were onto a good thing. And then we realized that there was a bit of a problem, because we couldn't get any decent jelly molds. And for us, like, the whole thing about jelly is having the amazing molds. So all the molds that we could find were on eBay, they cost hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
Yeah.
We just couldn't afford them. So we're like, oh dear, like, not only has Borough Market turned us down, but we now can't afford any molds. So this was a really bad idea getting into jelly.
Yeah.
But this was where I worked out that actually we can make our own molds. So I used the training that I had as an architect, and I started designing all these different molds in 3D on the computer and getting them printed out, and started vacuum forming them. And then suddenly we were able to make literally anything That's awesome. Jelly. So it went from there.
Because traditionally, most molds were made of, ceramic and glass, but...
Yeah, through the ages, they've been made of different materials as material technology has improved. So with Henry VIII, they're actually carved out of wood, amazingly. And then they've been in ceramic and different types of metals. So the Victorians had these beautiful and very functional copper molds.
Yeah.
Then they started doing cheaper ceramic molds, and then glass molds, and then aluminium molds. And then plastic molds, which are less functional, but
And what do you guys mainly work in? Plastic?
We use a very thin sort of plastic, which is a bit like copper, but less expensive.
Yeah.
If we had our druthers, if we could, we'd just do only copper. But it's punishing, and we've been electroforming our own copper molds as well, which is really fun. But it's sort of punishingly expensive.
Oh yeah.
But the copper's great. You get really good. It's really good for unmolding jellies. All you need to do is place your copper mold on the table, wrap a warm towel around it,
and
the jelly will just slip out.
And speaking of copper, making jellies, the process of actually combining the gelatin with sugar syrup, you advise that copper pots are some of the best materials to actually be cooking that in. Is that correct?
Oh, I think you can use anything.
Yeah,
we shouldn't use that.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know whether or not you were just copper fanatic.
No, we're not. No.
Copper for the molds is good.
So for the molds, it's nice, but tricky to get hold of. And also, we've been advocating copper for ages, and I did a class. Had a lady there, and she was so keen. She was so excited. She had just got a copper mold. She went straight home from the class, made her 6-year-old son a jelly, learning the things that she had learned. And poisoned him.
Copper poisoning.
Because the trick you got to look out for is good copper mold has got a tin lining.
Yeah.
And if it's come untinned, then you can get with the copper poisoning.
Did the boy turn copper? Kind of like those guys who have too much silver in their system.
He was kind of all right in the end. And actually, the good thing is he wasn't put off by jelly, but indeed wanted more of it to get him through his poisoning. But I was feeling pretty guilty.
Or maybe he had some kind of a new taste for copper now, and he was going to be like a copper vampire.
Maybe. Give him his superhero powers through jelly.
So from being able to create your own molds and, concoct your own recipes, what set you apart from, jellies that were already existing in London at the time?
Well, jellies didn't really exist at the time. So in London, we had Hartley's jelly, which is a bit like your equivalent of Jell-O.
Yeah.
So this comes in cubes rather than powder.
And that's been around for 100 years.
Around for 100 plus years.
Yeah.
Some of the supermarkets were making ready set jellies, but they had them in boring, non-molds, and they set them with weird stuff like pectin or tried to make them vegetarian. So there just wasn't anything decent around. But sort of at the time when we were starting rolling out the proper jellies, then lots of chefs at the same time were starting to do decent things and realizing the joy that jelly could bring to people as well.
I think when we're starting, as it coincided with chefs being very interested in textures, and of course jelly has this rather sort of mesmerizing texture where it's something between, it's just not really anything, is it? It's just somewhere between liquid and solid, and it's sort of silky and melts in your mouth, and of course you can turn almost anything into a jelly in some format. It's a good kind of supporting element on either a savory or sweet dish for chefs. So over the past 4 years, certainly in London, we've seen jelly migrate onto menus across the capital, which has been really, really exciting. If slightly expensive for us, because of course we've got to go try them all out and see if anyone's doing anything interesting that we're missing some tricks on. But it's cool, it's fun, and it also ties in with the there's been, for years in England, we've had this great complex about our food. Everyone says it is just rubbish, absolute crap. And I think people are trying to find a new pride, a new direction, and turning back to the food of the past. And you're getting chefs like Heston Blumenthal has just launched his fresh restaurant, Dinner in London, which every dish comes with a date. Specifying where it's inspired by, and so you're finding jellies, of course, tie in brilliantly with the British culinary tradition, because certainly in Europe, food and dining has been dominated by French cuisine, and there are only two things that we Brits could do better than the French. And one of them was jelly. The second was roasting. But in London, there's this real excitement of people getting back into the jelly and learning how to do it. Inspired by sort of stories of sneaky French chefs coming over to the cover of darkness to get the very special molds, that ingenious molds, in fact, that only the Brits knew how to make in the past. All these different factors, like textures, new cooking, respect for history and tradition, have all sort of combined to form this new fountainhead of excitement about jelly.
That, wow.
it's a good place to be.
Yeah, it's not a bad place. We're going to take a quick break and actually talk about the futurists.
Oh, right, wow.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com. We'll be right back.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to The Main Course Sundays at 12 p.m. with hosts Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer. They examine issues from the interconnected worlds of agriculture, cuisine, and sustainability. They sit down with key players in the chain, from producer to consumer, farmers, distributors, chefs, activists, and journalists. The Main Course explores every important component of the eating experience: how the farmers raise their product, the distribution channels that move the product, how the chefs prepare it, and how ethics and policy affect everyone involved. Again, that's The Main Course, Sundays at noon on the Heritage Radio.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com. If you've been listening in, you've been hearing a decent amount about jellies from Bumpus and Parr. That's jellymongers.co.uk. Man, those URLs, a lot of dots. co.uk. You couldn't just come up with .co.uk. Break it up. You guys don't control the internet in London?
Not yet.
So we were just talking about tradition, and the cultural context of jelly in London, but I kind of wanted to break away for a second, because all you do isn't just jelly per se. Sam and Harry have a very interesting resume of kind of like installation art, from an alcoholic architectural event where you walked in a cloud of breathable gin and tonic. A punch bowl flooded a building with about 4 tons of Cavassier punch, mm-hmm. if I'm correct. I think most recently you had a chocolate waterfall that had 5 tons of chocolate flowing, and you'd put on a protective suit, walk through a waterfall, yeah. make your own chocolates within this kind of contained environment. And most recently, a rabbit cafe.
Yep.
Can you explain that one to me a little bit?
Well, I mean, and this also slightly comes from jellies as well, because in England, everyone has these rabbit jelly molds. It's the most popular mold. Everyone goes, I had rabbit jellies as a kid. And we've always been utterly bewildered by it. Why rabbit jellies? The only way to get to the bottom of it was to get a whole herd of rabbits, open a cafe with them, and have people touch rabbits and eat.
Yeah.
So it kind of has resonance with one of our favorite cookbooks, which we think an awful lot of modern chefs have. It's their dark secret under their pillow, which is a futurist cookbook, which is this 1930s art manifesto written as a cookbook. Sort of weird, wonderful ideas, but the thing that was so prescient about it is it was really addressing ideas of, you know, the sort of sensory crossover in dining. So how certain sounds, how certain textures, how certain colors could affect your eating experience. The Rabbit Cafe for us was really an exploration of the haptic sense in the context of dining, because if you're touching stuff, you know, touch is normally neglected.
Yeah. You're mainly holding silverware.
You're holding silverware. You have napkins, but it's kind of a blank canvas.
Yeah.
The futurists were great because they had a special word for certain senses of touch that were paired brilliantly with different flavors and different textures, and they had whole dishes geared to this. So I think one of these pairings was eating a banana and stroking velvet or a woman's flesh.
Yeah,
they're quite rude and sensual as well. And so for us, we had eating pashmak, the Iranian cotton candy, as it were, and touching the rabbits, the herd of rabbits. Of course, it was Easter as well.
Yeah.
The difficulty you ran up against is in the UK. There's a lot of care and concern. People have a lot of love for pets, and rabbits are seen very much as a pet animal. We had a very difficult time explaining that the pashmak was in fact not actually rabbit fur that we'd scalped off the rabbits that people were eating. That made it tricky. But kind of, I think, added a frisson of danger as well.
Yeah, but I mean, these aren't just events of synesthesia, of reinterpreting senses. You also educate. This event itself also taught people a little bit about animal husbandry,
absolutely, because in the UK the rabbit is one of the most popular pets, but it's also the one that's widely abused.
Yeah.
And people don't know how to look after. We had a vet on hand to show people how to look after and treat rabbits with decent amount of respect.
Yeah. I mean, do most of your installations or art projects have some kind of moral to the end of them?
It's normally a sort of buried moral.
Yeah.
It's not one that you have to get to. We're not gonna bash you over the head with it. But if you wanna go there, if you wanna learn more, then it's really good if there's like this depth and sort of areas that you can explore. Say on this rabbit cafe, for example, not only did we have a vet there staffing at teaching people about how to look after rabbits, but also we'd worked with a neuroscientist, Dr. Ben Seymour, who is actually a specialist in sort of neuroimaging, and he was looking at how the sense of touch can affect the dining experience, and he put together a whole research brief on this that people could find out about. We also worked with a materials scientist and engineer, Dr. Zoe Loughlin at King's, and she's specifically interested in the textures of different eating implements and how they affect your sense of taste. Everyone knows that if you have almost anything with a wooden spoon, it's just going to be disgusting.
Yeah.
It's going to be filth. You know?
Yeah.
You don't want to go anywhere near it. And so, you know, she was able to bring these perspectives to light as well, that with the sort of exhibition notes about it, you could explore. But of course, yeah, that was only there if you wanted it. On the surface of it, it's like, you know, you're going into a cloud of gin and tonic. Who cares if we work with three doctors and an chemical explosives expert to get there? Or, you know, this one, you're going into a place where you're a massive purple room, and there are literally a whole huge herd of white albino rabbits bouncing around. It's a really sort of sensual, fun thing to do. But if you want to know more, it's there.
Yeah. Excellent. How many people wanted to know more?
Probably about 15%.
Yeah.
But everyone had a smile, so that's...
Oh, I'm sure. Thing. I'm sure. I don't see how you couldn't with a herd of... How did you say it? Albino rabbits?
Albino rabbits.
Yeah. Peter Greenaway, not to, tangentially talk about somebody else.
But he's
the master of tangents.
He's essentialist.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a man that understands how to trigger senses.
I can't believe I've actually mentioned the Italian futurist, Anastasia, Peter Greenaway, like in about three or four of my other shows. It's a very reoccurring theme. But Peter Greenaway, a cook, wife, thief, lover, a movie which is kind of like this operatic dinner party.
Yeah.
You worked with him on an event that ended up having a very interesting outcome, scratch and sniff.
Well, I think we all say we worked with him. I think that's quite generous
to him.
I think we kind of hijacked his film, actually. I've been really, really interested in the work of like William Castle. And of course, you know, he went for cult B movie stuff. He went for scratch and sniff cinema. So getting people to have actually, he didn't do scratch and sniff. I think he worked on pumping auditoriums full of different smells, but then had problems because you can get smells in, you can't get smells out. So you get this crazy overlap, and it doesn't quite work. But we wanted to do that, and we looked at all the different technologies available, and of course scratch and sniff, this forgotten, neglected something that everyone's had in their childhood and sort of 70s and 80s. It's a lot of fun. So we did a big ring round and found out someone that could provide scratch and sniff and micro encapsulate flavors if we came up with the aromas. And then we're able to pair it to a film. We're trying to look for what is the ultimate full-on experience film, and of course it's got to be Peter Greenaway's Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and a Lover, because it's so visceral, so powerful. Anyway, that if you add in that extra sensual layer of smell, it becomes almost overwhelming. And we had people nearly puking during the screening as people climb into the fetid meat locker. But then when we're doing this, we got in touch with Mr. Greenaway, and we actually ended up screening... doing the premiere screening of the pairing of it at the ICA when he was doing a talk there and did a sort of extended interview with him, which was hilarious. He was totally brilliant.
Yeah.
It was quite a lot of fun. I think it was around Valentine's Day as well, so he ended up telling us what he'd cook a lover in order to seduce them.
And that would be?
A crocodile. In fact, so
that's exactly what I was thinking.
But it was quite mean when we did the screening, because we did it on Valentine's Day, so lots of couples came along, and I don't know how many people had seen the film before, but the film was pretty shocking the first time you see it. But when you see the film and you start smelling the rotten meat, this, that, and the other, it was too much for some people, and some people weren't able to scratch the last smell.
And the last smell was
cooked flesh.
Of course,
the very, most exciting bit.
I also remember there's a scene, I think, earlier in the beginning of the movie where the guy is covered in
excrement,
feces. So did you have that indole smell?
We had that smell.
Excellent. So
that was one of the more challenging ones.
I think they got a nice smell of cigarettes after that to sort of cleanse the palate.
Cigarette to cleanse the palate.
There was one which was a floral in there.
Yeah.
So there was some that were okay.
Yeah.
And I think there's some food smells as well. But it's cool. It was really fun. And then with that, we're really keen on just, in that case, exploding the whole film out of the screen. And so you opened up a kind of cinema concession for the interval with all the regular stuff that you get at the cinema.
Yeah.
But had it as if it'd been possessed somehow by Greenaway's cook, thief, his wife, and her lover. And so, you know, we had a massive popcorn machine, but we had golden naked men in with all the popcorn. Bewilderingly, people still ate the popcorn. I think it might have been a bit sweaty as well. But then, you know, so we had 24 karat golden robed hot dogs, you know, weird and wonderful pick and mix selection, with lots of homemade candies. And we're working, I think at that stage, we're working very hard to get candies that flashed in your mouth, like your wintergreen ones, as well as popped. And I guess that's when we started becoming really obsessed with sweets as well, which has kind of led on more recently to doing this sort of artisanal chewing gum factory where people made chewing gum right from scratch and over 40,000 flavors, which is amazing. And literally, it's hard to believe it because so much has happened since yesterday. We were there at the chocolate waterfall. We had 5 tons of chocolate flowing at a rate of 12,000 liters an hour, which people were able to bottle up as a chocolate elixir and take home with them, which was unbelievable. Yeah. It was really, really fun.
So do you realize how far off from jelly some of these events are? But I mean, how amazing and crazy logistical nightmares they are. Why did you go from jelly to chocolate waterfall? Why did you go from jelly to scratch and sniff with Peter Greenaway?
I think we've always just been interested in what goes on with food, the joy that it can bring to people.
Yeah.
And that all started with jelly, but we do these other projects on the side to mix things up.
Yeah.
But we're always like back into jelly and making new molds and creating new flavors and things. So there's always lots of excitement on the jelly front.
Well, I think I think as well, actually getting into this all came out of the massive problems that we had with jelly. So one of the very early projects that we did with jelly is, Harry had said how he'd used his architectural training to work out how to make jellies in any shape. And we really wanted to push ourselves with this. So we challenged all the architects to come up with jellies in any shape, any size, whatever. We'd make all the molds. And so we had, you know, architects from around the world came up with thousands of different designs. We had to make them all. And we soon found out that you can't really make jellies that big unless you want a very sticky mess.
Yeah.
And what's more, as we said that we're going to exhibit all the designs as part of a jelly banquet, we soon found that we had 2,000 people coming along to see what was effectively jellies measuring about 7 inches by 7 inches. So we thought it was going to be totally underwhelming. Unless we started looking at all these other visual, textual, sound aspects to just amplify the experience. And so it's kind of almost a shortcoming of jellies that then prompted us to go into these larger, fuller scale food installations. And it's the things we've learnt from the jelly that has led us realize projects on a bit of a grander scale.
Speaking of grander scale, you have a dinner coming up for a few hundred. 1,500 people?
It's over 2,000
people. Over 2,000
people.
So
this is an event called Dining with Alice, which is taking place in Norwich in the east of England. And it's quite a magical Alice in Wonderland, as it obviously is, a themed experience. And the basic premise is you've got these 256 diners that are coming every night. And it starts off, it's in this grounds of this beautiful country house surrounded by a moat. They start off with some canapes and drinks. Then all of a sudden, out of the bushes, hundreds of waiters appear and they grab an individual diner and take them to one of 256 tables laid out amongst the grounds of the house. So it starts this whole sort of magical evening, and there's a whole logistic challenge. Every course... Everyone moves, and people are not moving from one table to the next table. They're moving hundreds of meters across the ground. So it's a real
true
challenge.
Movable feast. Yeah. So why the concept for this one? Why did you feel like someone had to move from one table to the next between courses?
This one is not actually our concept, but it's now our problem. so we went along for the one of the most amazing production companies, Artichoke, putting it all together, and they did things like have this massive robot elephant shut down all of London as it moved, paraded through the streets with 1.3 million people coming to watch it. They do cool stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, they thought that, I think they got the wrong idea about us. I think from our website that they thought we're some sort of big corporation or something. And so approached us to sponsor the event, and we came out of the meeting not sponsoring it, but actually doing all the catering. And the thing that for us was really exciting was a logistical challenge. And like, you know, actually, can we do this? Can we make it happen? That's going to be the challenge for next week, which is fun.
Yeah. So back to the logistics of jelly, to, you know, come full circle.
Okay.
I actually want to give people a couple slightly technical tips about jelly before we leave. One, how to actually make a jelly. we know there's gelatin, we know there's like a simple syrup of flavoring. What happens after that?
Well,
that,
I think that's the best way to think of it, is like literally any liquid that you'd like to drink, plus gelatin, use, we also use leaf gelatin, fine leaf gelatin, and use one sheet to every 100 milliliters or 100 grams of liquid you've got. We just make it on the scale. So it's a really, really simple ratio, and that's a good one for unmolding the jelly as well. So it's set slightly firmer than if you're setting it in a glass or something. And we just basically think of it like making cocktails. You just make your favorite cocktail, add the gelatin to that ratio, away you go.
Yeah, and you do make some cocktail jellies as well.
Yeah, well, I think you always should. And in fact, if you read sort of some Mrs. Beat and Agnes B. Marshall, one of these Victorian authors, every single one of their jelly recipes will end now chucking a glass of brandy. So we keep that spirit alive. It's not just sort of student vodka jello shots.
Yeah.
It can be very sophisticated. The alcohol adds real depth.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite jelly at the moment is probably one that I call the fruit salad of death. and it incorporates champagne, soda water, violet liqueur, Hendrick's gin, and then all of, that you sort of take some of those ingredients and then you infuse about five or six fruits in it and then settle the fruit in it as well.
I was about to say, the base of that already sounds like my favorite drink, the Aviation, with some bubbles. Yeah.
With the sparkles as well. It's a real winner.
Yeah. But alcohol causes a problem with setting.
Not normally, unless you put absolutely loads in.
Yeah.
So especially if it was overproof rum, you might have a problem.
Yeah.
You tried to set that neat.
So is there a percentage? Is there ratio?
It's only at like sort of 35-40% that alcohol starts disrupting gel strength.
So unless you make it like super strong, you
might
have a problem.
Almost like neat or something.
Oh yeah. So
if you're making a cocktail.
Yeah, you might as well just be taking just shots at that point. Yeah.
Like don't worry about it.
Lemon juice, acidity.
Acidity is more of a killer actually than alcohol, so just don't add too much lemon juice.
Kiwi, pineapples.
They're not good. You want to keep those up.
Yeah, but that's not actually because of the acidity. That's just the flesh-eating enzymes that you have in them.
Yeah.
Damn that bromelain.
Those flesh-eating enzymes. If we could only attack with pineapple and kiwis instead of napalm.
It's the way. Well, actually, I mean, funnily enough, we did a bit of an extension on the alcoholic architecture where we worked with Fairtrade fruit to make a ziggurat of flavor, which was like this 3-4-story pyramidal structure that people went through, and we had all this vaporized fruit inside. When you went through it, we worked with space scientists so that when you'd been through, you'd had one of your five pieces of fruit that you're supposed to eat every day just through your lungs and eyeballs. But of course, one of the fruits we were working with was pineapple, and it's got a protease enzyme in it, which will dissolve your lungs and eyeballs if you absorb it like that.
Yeah.
So it's quite important with that one that we denatured it, or else it would be just like going through a poisonous gas cloud.
Yeah.
So with that, the HACCP procedure was paramount.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, pineapple. Dangerous. I know with pork, too, it breaks down the actual flesh of the beast. You mentioned riban before. Striped.
Yeah, the stripes.
So milk is actually helps things set firmer.
Milk's good. Milk makes jelly set much firmer. So you can use less gelatin.
Yeah. So you make a blancmange and then
But probably don't make it with solid milk, as it were. So you want to add about 25% to water, probably.
Are there any other jelly tips that you'd like to tell us jello eating Americans?
Oh, jelly tips. Like whatever you do, use a mold. Like, you know, it's so, so important. Like the visual aspect of a jelly wobbling on a plate is, you know, so much of the joy of it. And yeah, if you can't get a mold, like when we started, we even just got Tupperware and started like, banging out of that. Or, you know, like when you have jelly boats at a kid's party, like halved orange and then filled up with jelly, you can do a really fancy version of that, which we're really keen on, which is where you make a tiny quarter size hole in the top of the orange using an espresso spoon to get out all the flesh.
Yeah.
That's particularly well with a mandarin. And then you fill it up with alternate layers of like a blancmange and the juice that you've got out of it, set as jellies. And then you can do the old trick where you flip it over so no one can see the hole, cut it in front of everyone at the table, and then miraculously there are these layers that no one can quite work out how they've arrived there. That's great fun. But all, yeah, like make sure you address the visual aspects of a jelly.
Yeah. It's funny because I think we had a Jell-O bowl in my house, and it was the Jell-O bowl. It wasn't a mold. It just was the bowl that Jell-O was made in. So I've always seen Jell-O as the same big wobbly shape. But speaking of terminology, wobbly, I love it as a descriptor. Are there any other Jell-O words? Is there a language that you guys use to describe jellies?
Well, I think God, my favorite jelly world actually is what they call it in German, where it's known as a Wackelpudding.
Wackelpudding.
Which I just think is an amazing term for a dessert. It's quite good. The other thing was Gottspiel is the other word for it. I'm probably saying it totally wrong.
Yeah.
Which is God's pudding as well. So that, like in Germany, they've got a firm respect for the most wobbly of desserts.
Yeah. And we have Bill Cosby.
You have Bill Cosby. But that's not, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we're talking, I think, about different desserts as well.
Yeah, very much so. Any other last jelly words before we send you back to
jelly
London?
Facts. Quiver is quite a good one.
Yeah.
And I think actually one of my favorite facts as well is that quite often the Victorians wouldn't even eat the jellies on their table. They would just set them out there instead of flower arrangements. And gently, as they were nudging the table throughout the meal as they're eating, all the jellies along would quiver, and it'd be apparently really rather titillating.
Yeah.
There's something rather lewd about the wobble of certain jellies, especially in certain forms.
We'll leave that adult show for another episode. But I wanted to thank Sam, Bumpus, Harry Parr, Jellymongers Extraordinaire. Check out the book by Sterling Epicure. Came out this May. Absolutely wonderful. Have a jelly party. Have a breathable gin and tonic party. Why not? Future things that you guys are working on that you might want to preview with us?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff. We're getting really into flooding at the moment. So there's a lot of epic flooding projects in the pipeline, which are quite fun.
Excellent. So get your slickers on. Check out jellymongers.co.uk. Thanks to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring the show. Jack Inslee for... again, doing everything in the studio. And I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, hoping to tune in next Tuesday at 3 for the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.